Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Chatting with Sherry. Today I'm going to welcome back the amazing Emmy-winning Brooks Watchell. He is a documentary filmmaker, an animator, a producer, a screenwriter, and now an author. He won an Emmy for Tuttenstein. He also won an award for his documentary with his partner, Cynthia Harrison, for Silver Tsunami. Welcome, Brooks.
Thank you very much. One slight correction. I'm not an animator. I write animation, but I don't animate.
Write animation. But you make pretty pictures.
Yes, I do make pretty pictures. But they're fairly static. They don't move on their own. At least I hope not.
Well, I know you've been fairly busy with everything that you've been doing. And you've been on our show several times, and I know people just love you. One of the things I'd like to ask you about is your how you got your Emmy for Tuttenstein, mostly about the animation and the craft of it.
Well, Tuttenstein was a show on Discovery Kids done by Porchlight Studios. My good friend Mark Seidenberg was the story editor and invited me to work on the show. And we were up against Disney shows, Warner Brothers shows, and they usually vote in blocks. So we were kind of amazed that we won. But we did, and we won. and we were up there just with blank stares, but really enjoying ourselves. And it was great. They announced I was in a row in the middle of the theater, and I had a good friend there, and my mom was there. She had come in, and they announced it, and we started walking down the aisle, and there was a woman in front of me who her husband was part of the production team, who was waiting, and I couldn't get past her to get up on stage. Finally scooted up on stage. They presented us with our Emmys. They took us backstage. They took our pictures, and then they handed us these little cards. I said, "What's the cards for?" And they said, "Well, that's so you can buy the pictures."
Really?
Really.
And we were the last. Pictures, you have to buy them?
We had to buy the pictures.
Wow.
And we did.
Oh, of course.
And then we
win an Emmy.
we were the last award of the evening, so when we got back into the banquet, all of the tables were taken. So the Porchlight group just kind of circled around one table holding the Emmys, and they vacated, and we got to eat.
Oh.
But it was wonderful.
That's really exciting, though. That's so exciting. What did your mom say?
Oh, she was thrilled. The friend I was there with was thrilled. And as we came out of the Kodak Center at the time, it came out on Orange, and there's the Magic Castle right there. So we went to the Magic Castle, and I was leaving the Emmy in the car, and my mom just picked it up and handed it to me and said, "You're taking it in."
Good for her.
We finished the celebration I was with, you know, a really wonderful friend and my mom, who's since passed on. So two of my favorite ladies, and we just had a ball. And also, I beat the Emmy curse because I actually worked the year that I won the Emmy.
Yeah, that's something that's interesting about the winning an award curse, because not just the Emmy, the Oscar and Golden Globe and all those. Is that just I don't know. I mean, that doesn't happen all the time, but I know that there's legends of it. What do you think of that legend?
I think it's probably not all that true, but I certainly beat it, and I worked a lot that year.
So it brought you good luck.
Yes, it did. It brought me good luck and a great table setting, and it's a letter holder because you can put letters in the wings.
Who is it that said that they have it in the bathroom?
I don't know. I have it on my living room table and surrounded, unfortunately, by letters and stuff right now. But it's great. When you get it, of course, it's not engraved. They send you that. and then you have to rip off the bottom, unscrew it, put on the engraved part, put it back together.
I didn't know that. So. I always thought you leave the Emmy, the award, and then they send it to you with the plaque on it. I didn't know that they sent you the plaque.
No, they send you the base, the round part that's engraved, and then it's got a little key. So you rip off the felt on the bottom, unscrew it, take off the blank, put on the one that's engraved, screw it back together, and there you
that's
are.
That's interesting. Oh, wow. A friend of mine, her parents were editors, and they had an Emmy, an Oscar, and a Golden Globe. And my brother and I, we were kids. We picked them up, and they're so heavy. Did you feel yourself full of adrenaline when you won it? Did you, like, push it up in the air and all that stuff like you see in the show?
Of course. And it is heavy. I mean, you could do curls with that thing. Yeah, I mean, you're up there. What you are is you are totally numb. And the photographs taken that night, I have a deer in the headlight look because you are totally numb. You know, is this really happening? Did I just win this? And it becomes kind of a blur.
Yeah. Yeah. I can see that. I always wondered about that.
Yeah, it lasts for a few days. It's just like this feeling of, it's hard to describe. It's just a feeling of wonder and strangeness and, you know, that, wow, I'm an Emmy winner for the rest of my life.
Yeah, that's true.
And then, of course,
you'll always know that.
And then reality sets in. You know, you have an Emmy and that and $5 will get you coffee at Starbucks. You do know what the lead line in your obituary is going to be.
Emmy-winning screenwriter.
kicks off, bites the dust, yeah.
You and your partner, Cynthia Harrison, you guys made a lot of wonderful documentaries. Do you want to tell about writing that and how that came about?
Cynthia and I had been working together in animation. And my friend Rich Mueller, who I also worked with in animation, and got me into documentaries. And I was working on a show called The Great Ship. And she'd been helping me with them. And we got an episode that was basically a clip show. And so they gave us the scripts of all of the interviews that they wanted us to pull clips from. And it was like 5 phone books. And so I asked Cynthia if she'd like to just work on it, because she practically had been. She'd been helping me, and we'd been writing animation together. And she was so good at it. She was just so wonderful at it that we just, you know, became a team with that as well. And we were writing The Great Ships. We were writing a whole bunch of shows for Monty Markham's company. And then she had found someone at the Sam Goldwyn preschool whose son was playing with her little daughter, who was a CGI animator. And he always wanted to do a show about air combat, but he didn't know how to go about it. And, well, we all got together and came up with a pitch for what became Dogfights. And then Cynthia found the company to pitch for. And we went in, and they loved it. And so we did, you know, we created the series, and it was a huge hit for the History Channel. And Cynthia did a lot of the line producing. We were both co-exec producers. We both wrote episodes and edited the scripts on episodes and gave lots of notes and the sound recording and the interviews. And when at the end of Dogfights, the History Channel kind of changed formats and stopped doing documentaries. They went to reality. And so we kind of got out of that game in television, though maybe we'll be getting back into it. Well, a couple of years ago, Cynthia was looking for a subject to do for a documentary, and she found at the Buck Institute up north a subject about aging and fighting aging and the demographics of the baby boomers and how that was just going to explode. And she talked to me about it, and I thought she'd found something great, and she financed, and we did a documentary short called Silver Tsunami, which is out now, and it deals with the impending disaster of massive number of baby boomers as they age.
Yeah, I saw that. They showed I forgot the Independence Channel. I think that was it. That they showed a bunch of documentaries, and I saw your show.
And
I thought it was really interesting.
Thank you. You can see the trailer on YouTube.
Oh,
so,
cool. Okay.
That one was a little interesting, more technical, because we had always written narration for the documentaries, and Cynthia thought she'd like to try it without doing narration, just being, you know, done by the clips, soundbite-driven. I wasn't for it at first because I love writing narration, but we gave it a try, and I thought it came out really well.
Cool. Well, that is a different idea, too, to have no narration. That's really different. Very clever.
Well, a lot of documentaries are doing that now, and I'm on the fence. I think it depends on the subject. Some subjects work well that way, and some subjects work better with narration. I think if you're doing a historical documentary, like Dogfights was, that it works better with narration because there's just so much information you have to give out so quickly.
I saw I think it's called American Heroes Channel. They had Dogfights on for, like, weeks. Did you see it?
Yes, the show is still very popular. It's run all over the world. In fact, in England, they took our scripts and had a British actor doing the narration. So we heard some of that, and it's much more laid back than the driving narrator we used. But it's the same dialogue, but with a British accent.
Oh, that's cool.
It sounds much more dignified.
Oh, I bet.
But a little less dynamic.
Who was the British actor? Is he known?
I have no idea. I should have checked the credits, but I didn't.
Oh, okay. That's cool, though. I like that. I like that they picked their own person to do the narration.
Well, I'm on the fence about it because we directed the narrator in many, many, many of the episodes, and we got a certain tone and pace and rhythm and dynamic that we wanted, that we felt represented the show. And when someone else comes in and changes that, it's not quite the show we had in mind.
Oh, I didn't think of that. Oh, so were you upset?
No, not really upset. I mean, that's just business. And if anyone wants to hear what we had in mind, they watch the American version of the show.
Yep. And I think they're still showing it on American Heroes Channel.
Yeah, they're showing it. I think that show is going to be with us for a long time. It seems to have an amazingly long shelf life, and it's a very exciting show. I'm still very proud of it.
Yeah, I love the World War I episodes. They're so cool.
Thank you very much. For those people that don't know, because we haven't described, Dogfights was a documentary series on the History Channel. We would interview the pilots and the aviators and then use computer animation to bring their combat to life. So it really put the viewer right in the cockpit.
It's really exciting. It's really fascinating. It gives you an idea of what those guys went through.
I'll give you a little genre, cross-genre piece. During the Writers Guild strike, I met the producers of Battlestar Galactica. And they were watching our Dogfights episodes to get ideas on how to do their space dogfights, and they were huge fans of the show.
Oh, that's so cool.
And I was a huge fan of their show, so it was a great mutual admiration society.
Yeah, I love that series. Yeah, Lucy's was in it too. Lucy Lawless was in that too.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
but
love their dogfights. Oh, go ahead.
Yeah, so they were watching ours to get ideas. So one of the problems when they see all these dogfights in outer space is that the craft are still behaving like they're in an atmosphere. you don't have to
that
bank.
Is true.
My dad pointed that out to me when I took him to see Star Wars when it first came out. He was a 20-year naval aviator, and he pointed out they're flying like they're in an atmosphere, not in a vacuum.
I wonder, well, I know that he said that, like, when he brought music and stuff like that, it was to make it more exciting. Do you think that might be why?
I think also there's a certain audience expectation of what a fighter plane looks like and how it moves. And they were using World War II combat footage to base these special effects on, so probably a whole lot of reasons. And the music was great. I often comment, if you look at the film Top Gun, and then you look at the attack on the Death Star in Star Wars, that Top Gun, which is basically just, I think, Berlin pop songs running in the background, as opposed to John Williams' Star Wars music, that if you go back and look at Top Gun, it probably looks dated now, but if you look at the attack on the Death Star in Star Wars, it's still dynamic and exciting because that music still works.
John Williams, you can't beat John Williams, right?
Well, I think that there are times when having an actual score is more appropriate and more effective than just putting a recording, a record behind the action.
Yeah, and he seemed to understand it much deeper than somebody just putting music in. You know, there's a feeling there.
I mean, he's a brilliant composer, and he's also a brilliant film composer, and understand. I mean, he was inspired for Star Wars by Eric Wolfgang Korngold, who had done Robin Hood, the Seahawk, and Korngold approached film as opera without libretto. So Williams was using leitmotifs and things like that harkened back to the Korngold-type scores, and it worked brilliantly. In fact, it's fairly well known that the Star Wars fanfare is a variation of the fanfare that Eric Wolfgang Korngold wrote for the 1940 film King's Row. And if you go on YouTube, there's even King's Row versus Star Wars, and you can hear the two fanfares together.
Ooh, that's really cool. I never knew that. That's something for me to check out on. Thank you. We have a caller. Hold on, let me just see who that is. Hello, caller. This is Sherry. Please let me have your name and where you're calling from. Hello? I guess they're shy.
Hello?
Hello?
Hello, can you hear me?
Now we can hear you. Hi.
I'm so sorry. Hi. my name is Mindy Miller, and I'm calling in to ask Brooks Wachtel.
Okay.
Mr. Wachtel, I'm just very curious. You have such a long and varied history in writing, and you seem to do so much with your directing and your photography, and you're so talented in so many areas. If you had, it's kind of a double-edged question. One is, how did you decide that you wanted to become a writer in the first place? And the second part of that question is, if you could only bring it down to one thing that you would be able to do, what would it be?
I don't think we have enough time.
Okay.
I've always written from the time I was, probably in elementary school. I've always been writing something. And originally I wanted to be a writer.
Did you know at a young age that that's what you wanted to do and that's what you were meant to do?
I wanted to be a filmmaker. I directed and wrote many student films and a feature film. But when it came to make a living at it, I was trying to get some low-budget films, some independent films going, and back then they weren't really called independent. They were, B-films. And I wasn't getting the projects launched, and I went into animation, and they were actually willing to pay me, and, I wrote some, and they offered me more, and I pursued it, and I was making a living at it and pretty soon had a career just writing, and since there were really nice paychecks involved and pretty steady work, I just went with it.
So you really didn't start out to be an animation writer per se. You kind of fell into it, is that right?
I don't know anyone in my generation that actually came into the business with the intent of being an animation writer. It's where we found ourselves, and that's not derogatory. I mean, it's delightful, but usually we were writers, and there's no such thing as an animation writer. There's writers who work in animation. We are writers, and we found ourselves in it, and we found ourselves employed, and it's a lot of fun. I mean, you get to write some great stories, so It's where I found myself, and then later I found myself in documentaries as well, and some live action, and now a novel.
Right. And now let me ask you, thank you.
Thank you very much. We really appreciate it, but we're really limited on time, but I really appreciate you calling. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Okay.
I've never had a call-in before. That was wonderful.
That's exciting.
Very great questions.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. But I didn't mean to interrupt her, but I know you wanted to talk about Lady Sherlock and the process and what's going on with her and all that. So I wanted to give you lots of time so you could do that.
Well, Lady Sherlock is a novel I've written. It is coming out, I believe, in April from Wordfire Press. The manuscript, the illustrators, like 50-some illustrations, were sent in about a month ago, and they're getting the advanced reader copies ready, and I guess we'll soon be starting on the layout and the actual physical production of the book and the e-book, because it will be both. And it's just been very exciting. I've written over 100 animation assignments, lots and lots of documentaries, features, but most everything I've written has been in script form, and this is my very first novel, and it was just a delightful experience and a very different creative experience. I had a wonderful editor, a lady named Sherry Goodhart, and I think it's going to be a really good book. I hope it finds a readership. And it's about a lady detective in 19...
I wanted you to tell what it's about.
Oh, it's about a lady Sherlock Holmes in 1906, and it's a plot that might involve the supernatural, might involve world politics, might involve an ancient curse, but you have to read it to really find out what's going on. It's got a great heroine and I think a really exciting villainess and lots of action and some fun characters and a lot of illustrations.
That's really cool. I mean, I've seen the cover and stuff. It's so beautiful. Why don't you talk a little bit about the difference between writing a novel and writing a screenplay?
Well, first, let me start off by saying writing is writing, and there are similarities in all. You have to have structure. You have to have plot. You have to have theme. You have to have character, dialogue. That's the same on all of it. When you get into the technical differences, as in a movie, First, a movie is usually a specific time frame. You know, it's 120 pages, 106 pages, but basically you're aiming at a 90-minute, two-hour movie. Television, the time constraints are even more stringent. If you're doing an hour show, it's about 44 minutes of content. And when you're writing a screenplay, basically you're limited to what you can see and what you can hear. And you don't have that inner dialogue and inner comments that you have in a novel. I mean, you can do some in voiceover, but you should really limit that. Where a novel, you have to create the world. You have to be much more explicit in the backgrounds and the appearance of everything. You're basically creating the world, because a screenplay, as beautifully written as screenplays can be and as much fun to read as they can be, are not finished products. They're a blueprint for a movie. And the movie itself is the finished product. But a novel is the final result. It is the finished product.
Did you find the transition exciting? Did you find it hard? How did you find it?
I found the process, and my editor was a huge help in this, of getting the first drafts were more like a novelization of a screenplay. It took a learning curve to get it to be a novel. And I mean, it's the first novel that has a lot more words. I mean, it's a much thicker, denser piece of writing, and you're encouraged to do things that you were no longer encouraged to do in screenplays, like lots of description. And also, when you're dealing with a novel, you can deal with what a character feels, how the water is cold, or they're hot, or they're... I mean, you can deal with tactile senses. You can deal with that inner monologue that you don't do in a screenplay. And screenplays these days, you're encouraged to be so succinct, even in your description, which is a shame. Film dialogue, should be very short, to the point, succinct, sharp, and only used when you can't show something visually. I mean, dialogue in both a novel and a script should either give information, reveal character, or get a laugh. But
yeah.
When you're writing a novel, you can go on a little more. I tried actually not to do that. I tried to keep the dialogue fairly cinematic. But, well, if you look at a Golden Age Hollywood script, they are written much more novelesque. There's much more description, much more detail than we are allowed as screenwriters to do today.
Do you find that freeing? That you could do that when you were writing the novel, that you were able to explore the scenery, the dialogue and stuff, an inner dialogue, I mean, than you would in a screenplay?
I won't say freeing because they're two different disciplines and they're both a lot of fun and they both have their own challenges. But I will say it was a lot of fun. It was fun to be able to do that. And I guess in that sense, it was liberating.
Cool.
But again, I enjoy writing both, and they're both different disciplines. I do wish that modern screenplays were a little more like Golden Age screenplays, because they're just more fun to write. I mean, if you ever get a chance to look up, to read a script from Golden Age Hollywood, I think you'll be amazed at how denser they are than modern screenplays.
Yeah, I actually have Bringing Up Baby because it's one of my favorite movies.
It's a very funny film.
Oh, it's such a great film, and the script is just amazing. I basically ate it up.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say that I thought that was a little ahead of its time. That's all. Go ahead.
Well, I don't think it did very well, actually, when it first came out. It's now Bringing a Baby. I don't think it actually did well. It was maybe at the tail end of the screwball comedies, but it is a brilliant film, acted, written, directed. I mean, it's just working on all cylinders. And to watch it today, and as Christopher Reeve said, that he had based his Clark Kent and Superman on Cary Grant's performance in Bringing a Baby.
I didn't know that, really. Oh, wow,
to,
yeah, I could see that.
Yeah, down to taking the finger to push the glasses back up on the bridge. So,
Cary was brilliant in it. Oh, my God, he just, he lit up the screen. He was so brilliant.
He was. So one thing, if you're going to go into the business, watch old movies. You can be inspired or steal.
That's
but
another
I'm,
thing I want to ask you about.
Mm-hmm.
As an expert, don't you find it sort of sad that some young filmmakers won't even watch black and white movies?
Yes, I do find it sad, or they won't watch old films, or they're just interested in the now. It's sort of like taking someone to the museum, a great art museum, and they say, "Don't show me any paintings that were painted before 2000."
Yeah.
I mean,
they miss all the wonders.
But actually, a younger friend of mine, a neighbor in the building where I live, he gave me a book, and I said, thanks, why? He said, well, a friend gave me the book, and you're the only one I know who reads. And I found that a very terrifying statement.
Oh, God. Yeah. I've had that, too. It breaks my heart.
I said, you're the only one I know who reads books. I should qualify that. Well, I hope he reads mine when it comes out.
I hope he reads your book, too. I want to read your book.
and I really hope you are not an isolated case in that.
But, no, I mean, I know that there's a lot of mystery fans out there. I mean, I know that there's a lot of people who love to read. You don't hear from them because they're kind of shy to admit it now because it's not cool.
Well, that's unfortunate because, the Internet is brilliant. It's full of information. But even when doing the documentaries, we found if we really wanted to go into depth, we had to go to books.
Yep, absolutely.
And of course.
Go ahead.
No, no, you. After you.
No, we're coming to the end, so I wanted you to finish what you were saying.
Well, just books open up a universe that is just, you know, it's not only opens up a universe, it's voices from the past talking directly to you. I mean, they're marvelous things, and long may they reign.
Yeah, I love books. Like, there's something about a book that opens your imagination that, for me, film and books go hand in hand. I like to watch a movie first and then read the book, and to me that will open up the movie that I had just seen. That's my way of doing it. But I think there's just, go ahead.
I've done adaptations of books, and many times you do have to make vast changes to make them work from one medium to the other.
Oh, yeah. Oh, absolutely. We're at the end. I'm so sorry. I there's like 1,000 questions I could still ask you, Brooks. Thank you so much for being on the show. I really appreciate it.
Thank you very much for inviting me, Sherry.
Brooks' book, what date do you know, have approximate date for when your book's going to come out?
It's called Lady Sherlock, Circle of the Smiling Dead, and I believe it's sometime in April.
Sometime in April. Okay. So look out for his book. I will let you know on my website and everything because I'm a big fan too. Thank you, Brooks, so much for being on the show.
My pleasure. You take care.
Thank you. And thank you for chatting with Sherry.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.